All politics are economic, and apparently all economics are political. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl, who, yes, is still on vacation, and good for him. It's Friday, July 20th. Thanks for joining us today. We begin, as we always do on Fridays, with the weekly wrap, where we try to explain the economics behind just a few of the big things you've been hearing in the news in, 6 minutes of live radio. Joining me today are Sheila Kolhatkar of The New Yorker and CNBC's John Harwood. Welcome to you both.
My pleasure.
Hey,
so I'm going to start with you, John, because conveniently enough, the president was on your network, CNBC, and in that interview said he'd be willing to go dollar for dollar with China and place tariffs on all $500 billion worth of Chinese goods. So where do things stand with China now?
Well, with President Trump, it's always hard to separate the bluster from what he actually intends to do. But he's certainly taken the trade conflicts further than many people thought that he would. So I think you have to take his words seriously, and I think you have to take the potential risk to the American economy seriously. Tony Fratto, who was a Treasury official during the George W. Bush administration, tweeted today that markets are way undervaluing the potential impact of a trade war, and I think he's right. If the president not only implements those big tariffs against China, but also implements the auto tariffs on national security grounds that he's talking about, that would significantly, in my view, raise the risk of recession.
And Sheila, the president talks a lot about resetting the trade imbalance between the U.S. and China, but a lot of economists, to be blunt, say that the president doesn't seem to necessarily understand what a trade deficit is. Where do you fall on that?
Well, there was a really interesting analysis in the Wall Street Journal today of all of the counties where the most manufacturing jobs in America are concentrated, and every single one of them went very strongly for Trump in the presidential election. So I think that is actually the explanation for everything that he's doing and saying. He's sort of speaking to those voters in particular. And I think there's a very strong chance that he does not really familiarize himself with the details of trade deficits and how they work. And instead, he's trying to send a signal to that base of voters who, he really connects with.
And so maybe it doesn't matter. It seems like long term, it's going to matter whether he understands the economics, though.
Yes, unfortunately, it will eventually matter.
Yeah. All right, John, back to the other things coming out of that was very well understated, Sheila. John, coming back to that CNBC interview, and then again on Twitter this morning, the president showed his displeasure with the Federal Reserve over rate hikes, and there has been a big uproar over this. What have you been hearing?
Well, the president prides himself on breaking the norms of his office, and as he said, while he was doing it, he was delighted to break the norm of presidents commenting pretty aggressively on Fed actions. He said he couldn't care less with the idea that the president's not supposed to do that. Now, I will say, though it had a short-term effect on markets, on the dollar, I would not expect anything to come of this in terms of the Fed's actions, because the president doesn't know much about public policy. And much of his government now ignores the things he says as much as they can get away with. I would not expect Jay Powell to be quickly responsive to what the president is saying. And in fact, I would expect him to stay on the path that he's on.
Yeah, I mean, I'll be a little self-serving for a minute. When Kai Rizdahl interviewed Fed Chair Powell last week, he reaffirmed the Fed's independence. He said, quote, "We have a long tradition here of conducting policy in a particular way, and that way is independent of all political concerns." With that in mind, Sheila, what does the president get out of this? It's not the first time that a president has gone up against the Fed and essentially lost.
Well, surely the president, someone has surely told him that in previous periods where interest rates were going up, the economy slowed, the stock market slowed down. He must know that the strong market and strong job growth has been one of his strongest assets politically. So I am sure he's a little concerned about how this could affect the economic indicators that he likes to tout. But yes, as already stated, he is another example of how he just really does not care that he's not supposed to be interfering politically with those who are in charge of, managing the economy. And he's clearly trying to send a signal. And yes, the professionals at the Federal Reserve will probably ignore his signal.
And the strange thing, Molly, is I've got to say, the trade actions that he's taking are likely to harm the economy more than anything the Fed is doing in trying to manage monetary policy.
Right, right, because it's very gradual, as we know. Back to you for a second, Sheila. There's corporate news from the EU this week, of course. The EU's antitrust regulator slapped Google with a $5.1 billion fine. Now that the ball is rolling on this antitrust regulation, which is not new from the EU, but seems to maybe be getting intertwined a little bit with the trade dispute. In fact, that came up from President Trump on Twitter today. What do you make of that?
Well, it really, with the EU's actions towards Google, really highlights the incredible difference in antitrust policy in the U.S. and in Europe. And domestically here, we have largely stopped enforcing antitrust laws. And there are a lot of people who are concerned about the power of the big tech companies and whether that's stifling innovation. And there's, of course, a good chance at some point in the future the Americans are going to have to sort of catch up on some of this. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, yes, there's a strong risk that this could become very politicized. Google is surely very unhappy about this, and all of the other big tech companies must be watching it really closely.
That's The New Yorker's Sheila Kolhatkar and CNBC's John Harwood. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks.
Have a great weekend.
On Wall Street, the trade talk and a bunch of positive corporate earnings had a fight, and the results were mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's move on to the second chapter in this week's U.S.-China Chronicles. President Trump today accused Beijing of manipulating its currency. This is not a new charge, but one thing that has happened is an 8% fall in the Chinese currency against the dollar since the trade spat began in the spring. And that does happen to help Chinese exporters, which means now we not only have talk of a trade war, but of a currency war as well. Marketplace's Scott Tong, our former bureau chief in Shanghai, reports.
In contrast to President Trump, Chinese policymakers aren't always so overt about punching back. But an 8% drop in the currency, the yuan, yeah, that seems at least partially on purpose, says economist Bill Adams with PNC Financial Services.
It was telling for me that the Chinese yuan was appreciating against the U.S. dollar in the first quarter of 2018, and the depreciation of the yuan began after the U.S. started to enact tariffs on Chinese imports.
Here's how depreciation helps Beijing. It's about to get hit with a second round of U.S. tariffs, 10% taxes on $200 billion worth of Chinese soy sauce, vacuum cleaners, fridges, all kinds of stuff. So prices will go up. But a cheaper currency pulls prices back down effectively. It offsets. Brad Setzer is International Economics Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations.
I think a weaker currency is probably the easiest way for China to limit the trade impact of U.S. tariffs.
But there are risks. China's weak currency already has President Trump threatening a broader trade war.
Further depreciation almost certainly would have been expected to have produced a political reaction in the U.S.
And a weak yuan, also called the renminbi, spooks investors in China, says economist Derek Scissors at the American Enterprise Institute.
So the number one concern for the Chinese is they have to go slow and not alarm people who hold renminbi, because otherwise they'll sell. They'll sell, you know, assets in the Chinese stock market, they'll sell Chinese bond holdings, etc., and they'll take the money out of the country.
It's a trade-off, perhaps a realistic trade-off in a trade war. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Please indulge me for just a minute. We have just launched something I'm pretty excited about for all you Alexa users. It helps you get smart about the economy, pop culture, tech, and everything that's going on. I will try not to set off your Echo, but all you have to do is say, "Alexa, make me smart," and you'll get a new explainer every weekday from me and Kai Rizdal. And of course, you can always say, "Play Marketplace" from any smart speaker. This summer is the 10th anniversary of when the world met our beloved WALL-E, the little trash compactor that could. The movie went on to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Picture and made $500 million worldwide. It also left another legacy, a picture of Earth's possible future that felt all too possible then, and maybe even more so now. To decipher what WALL-E was trying to tell us, I talked to Hugo Award-winning science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson. Welcome to the program.
Oh, my pleasure, Molly.
I know you try to avoid this, the prescience conversation, but at least in your own work. But this movie is remarkably prescient in some ways. It came out in 2008, which was just about a year after the first iPhone came out, and depicts an eventual state of humanity where people stare at screens all the time. You could argue that 10 years later, that's remarkably accurate. What do you think about that? And what else do you see in the film that you think is becoming true before our eyes?
Well, it wasn't a hard call to make in 2008. It was just a social commentary on what was already happening at the time. And 2008 and now are not that different socially and culturally. I guess you could just say more has happened. And I think WALL-E was a good intervention because there's good things that's happened in the last 10 years, as well as the bad parts of the consumer society coming more and more true. There's also the Paris Accord. There's a worldwide awareness of climate change and of environmental collapse. And that was also true in 2008. So I would just say that the situation has been exacerbated in a way that WALL-E is pointing out. Things aren't as bad as they are in WALL-E, but we're trending in that direction, both in the good ways and the really bad ways.
Well, yeah, there's also this very obvious message about how convenience becomes enslavement. I mean, is not an uncommon theme in science fiction. And I wonder if it's always been obvious.
Really, the humans in that movie, they're essentially like infants. Adulthood has been taken away. And against that, WALL-E looks like Sisyphus. You know, he's a worker bee. He has a stupid job to package trash into giant skyscraper-like columns. It's pointless in a way, and he's just beavering away at it. But then he begins to make all kinds of mature adult decisions, falls in love, joins a revolution, and overthrows the social order that already exists. The message is super clear, and I think it made people uncomfortable at the time in 2008, and I think it still should make us a little uncomfortable.
Did it? Do you think what were the conversations about that? What were people saying?
Well, conservative commentators were saying this is some kind of environmentalist scare message. And I first saw WALL-E in a movie theater in Bar Harbor at the edge of Acadia National Park. It was middle America on a summer vacation, seeing that movie in a theater where you got to eat pizza while you watched the movie. And every movie gets a round of applause. Well, WALL-E did not get a round of applause. The audience knew that it was being criticized for its habits. And there were lots of giant soft drinks in the theater as people were watching the movie. And then we were sitting back in recliners because of the pizza format of this particular theater. It's one of the very few satires that I think pokes a needle right in the heart of our lifestyle.
You know, the way that humanity is essentially saved is through the actions of a few. I mean, I'm thinking about the theater that you described watching this movie in. Not everybody wakes up. Not everybody wants to. In fact, most, it seems like don't, right? We are too comfortable to embrace autonomy and independence. And I guess I wonder what the film also says about leadership.
Well, I think it's a good message in that the leadership can come from anywhere and it needs to be mass sourced from below. And if anybody starts it, it begins to spread. So I like it. It's really a revolution from below by ordinary activities. I think Americans do feel cocooned by crap, and people go on vacation in order to do something simpler and harder. People go down to the gym to do something physical. I mean, all of these are commodified versions of things that you can do for free just by walking out your front door and taking a walk down the street or planting a little garden if you have land, and if not, put it in pots. The urge is there. This is what I'm thinking. The urge for more physical, bodily life, a more balanced life where you aren't just a consumer but are also producing something of your own. I think that urge is there. So the movie speaks to something really deep inside all of us.
Author Kim Stanley Robinson, thanks so much for talking with me.
My pleasure, Molly.
Thank you. coming up.
And I will assure you that no megalodons were hurt in the filming of this movie.
The origin story behind summer's latest blockbuster. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was basically flat, losing just 6 points to close at 25,058. The NASDAQ gave back less than 0.1%, or 5 points, to finish at 7,820. The S&P 500 also dipped less than 0.1%. That is 2 points. See, everybody was just confused about what to do. It ended the day at 2801. For the week, the Dow added 0.1%. The NASDAQ erased just under 0.1%, and the S&P was flat. President Trump, as you heard, kept up his criticism of the Fed. Financial stocks kept up their gains. Goldman Sachs toted up 0.8%. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 1.25%. Citigroup secured a gain of 0.3%. General Electric dropped more than 4% after reporting weak quarterly earnings. Seems there was not enough power in GE's power business. Yeah, sorry. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.89%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
We heard from John in Austin, Texas, not too long ago, who says he and his wife think Marketplace is the most informative and creative radio program in America, which is nice to hear. If you agree with John, please join him as a Marketplace investor by donating online at marketplace.org. And thanks to John and everybody who makes our work possible.
This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Now to some policy news that is not about trade or China. On Capitol Hill this week, the Trump administration proposed a revamp of the 45-year-old Endangered Species Act. The law currently protects more than 1,660 animal and plant species at risk of extinction. Since 1973, the law has said that scientific study should dictate how regulators decide what species to protect. But the proposed new rules would let regulators consider the economic and business consequences of protection efforts. Marketplace's Renata Sago has more.
The Endangered Species Act is credited with keeping the gray wolf, the lynx, and the piping plover bird alive today. But it's also the reason why many businesses and landowners are not thriving, according to Kathleen Scama, who heads the Western Energy Alliance. It's a trade group for oil companies. She says the Endangered Species Act restricts development on land that may not even contain threatened plants and animals.
So it's constraining our ability to operate and not really delivering effective species protection.
Scama says the new proposed rules would allow businesses and landowners to create jobs, you know, to balance preservation with development. Bill Snape is senior counsel at the Center for Biological Diversity. He says the act already has that balance.
The process already allows them to have their concerns taken into account, to have their concerns sometimes even predominate decisions.
He says this push for new rules is just a way to give the oil, timber, and ranching industries more business. But Rob Gorton thinks economic considerations are long overdue. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says there's no comprehensive data on the cost to businesses, landowners, and taxpayers for protecting species.
It's only reasonable that we should know what the cost is.
What's next is a 60-day comment period during which people on all sides are likely to have plenty of opinions. I'm Renata Sago for Marketplace.
Earlier in the show, we talked about an old summer blockbuster, WALL-E. Well, let's go back a little further to 1975, when Jaws became the first movie to gross over $100 million, the first summer blockbuster. Shark fever strikes again in a few weeks with The Meg, a story about Carcharodon megalodon, the largest shark that ever lived. The movie is based on a novel written by Steve Alton. He's got a similar story to lots of us of a certain age. He saw Jaws in 1975 and got obsessed with sharks. And it was a good choice. Sharks are a moneymaker. After Jaws, we got Shark Week in 1988, arguably Discovery Channel's most lucrative annual event. It starts next week, actually. And in August, let's not leave this out, the world will be treated to a sixth Sharknado movie on Sci-Fi. So what is the deal with sharks? Why are they such box office winners? Steve Alton, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Molly.
So you have essentially made an entire career out of shark stuff, so to speak. What is it about sharks that captivated you? What's your personal connection to the the Megalodon story?
Well, it sort of started when I was 15 and saw Jaws in theaters, and then that got me to read Peter Benchley's book, and then I started reading everything I could find on great whites and true life attack stories, and there was always a little blurb about Carcharodon megalodon, the prehistoric cousin of the great white. Well, flash ahead 20 years, and I'm 35 years old, struggling to support a family of five, and I happened to pick up a Time magazine article in August of 95 that featured the Mariana Trench, the deepest part in the ocean. And the article talked about hydrothermal vents and life at the bottom of the ocean, and I thought, you know, this would be a pretty cool place for that shark that I read about when I was younger to be hanging out. I wonder if it was would be scientifically feasible. So I went to the library and did some research because there was no internet back then, and found out that it was feasible and that the mystery, there was a big mystery about how these sharks disappeared. And I thought, you know, I think I'm going to write the book.
Why do you think that shark material, you know, from Jaws to Shark Week, now likely to this franchise, why is it such a consistent moneymaker?
Well, I mean, people like to be scared in the movies, and sharks are scary creatures, and great whites are the scariest of them all, except for Megalodon, which was the big great white. So, you know, I think this movie is going to up the ante on it, but, you know, if it's done well, then it can make for a movie that people want to see over and over again.
You mentioned the science aspect and that you did the research to see if it would actually be possible, which thank you for verifying my absolute worst fear that Megalodon might be down there. But, you know, one criticism
of... Are you planning a trip to the Mariana Trench anytime soon?
It's going to come out. I already saw it in the trailer. You mentioned the kind of scientific aspect. A lot of criticism, even of, for example, Shark Week and Jaws, is that it's not always very scientifically based, and it ends up demonizing sharks. Do you worry about that, or does this have an answer to that?
Well, if you read the books, you'll see that I'm very much into the ecology of the ocean and protecting sharks. And, in fact, in the book, they're trying to capture it, not trying to kill it. But, you know, back when Benchley wrote Jaws, he got a lot of grief and felt horrible because sharks were being killed, you know, after Jaws. I think we've woken up to the fact that, you know, sharks are an integral part of the ocean's ecology and health. And, you know, this ridiculous practice of killing these sharks for their shark fins to make soup is just got to stop. So, and I will assure you that no megalodons were hurt in the filming of this movie.
Steve Alton, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Steve actually has written six books about the Meg since 1997, and that sixth book just came out this week. I would also like to point out that Sharknado has spawned two spin-off movies, and of course, there is a Sharknado panel at Comic-Con today in San Diego. It is, of course, the annual festival for lovers of all things superhero and geek chic. You can read an article about the business of Comic-Con and its place in pop culture over at marketplace.org. This final note before we go, marijuana is here to trade. The Canadian company Tilray started trading yesterday on the NASDAQ. It is the first cannabis grower to have an initial public offering on a U.S. exchange, and it ended its first day up more than 32%. Recreational marijuana will be legal in Canada in October of this year, and Tilray is using its IPO to raise money to continue its growing and processing operations. And while those of us in the U.S. can invest in Tilray, the company can't sell its products in the United States at all because even though several states have legalized weed, it's still illegal under federal law. Marijuana economics are weird. All right, we got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, basically flat today, losing just 6 points. The NASDAQ gave back less than 0.1%. The S&P 500 also dipped less than 0.1%, just 2 points. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. And I am Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.